The Handmaid's Tale is a 1985 novel by Canadian author Margaret Atwood. It is a near-future dystopia set in New England in a totalitarian Christian theocracy that has overthrown the United States government. So about 5 years ago, as we're really starting to watch the legislature, I noticed that when a shockingly restrictive reproductive health bill came up, younger reproductive rights activists would sometimes say, wow, this is like The Handmaid's Tale in real life. After a few times, I felt the need to read the book and see the movie. And the book is often assigned reading in gender studies classes and is well known among feminist activists. So how true to life today is this future dystopia written in 1985? So The Handmaid's Tale was set in the Republic of Gilead, a theocratic military dictatorship formed within the borders of what was formerly the United States of America, beginning with a staged attack that kills the president and most of Congress, a fundamentalist Christian Reconstructionist movement, calling itself the Sons of Jacob, suspends the United States Constitution under the pretext of restoring order. They are quickly able to take away women's rights, largely because of electronic records. The new regime moves quickly to consolidate its power and reorganize society along a new militarized hierarchical model inspired by the Bible. In this society, human rights are severely limited and women's rights are even more curtailed. For example, women are forbidden to read. The story is told in the first person by a woman called Offred, literally of Fred. The character is one of a class of women kept for reproductive purposes and known as the handmaids by the ruling class. Offred describes her life during her third assignment as a handmaid, in this case to Fred, a highly ranked military official and his wife. So, of course, the election of Donald Trump and the breakdown of democratic norms has tightened the correlation kind of alarmingly. And since the election, The Handmaid's Tale has now been adapted into a new TV series on Hulu. And if you have seen protests at state houses and courts, also at Notre Dame when Vice President Pence went to the commencement of women wearing these robes, silently walking in pairs, they're referencing The Handmaid's Tale. But wait a minute. The Handmaid's Tale as a future dystopia? Not to black women. To black women, this is no future dystopia. It's the past, and it's the past that's not even past. What about Sally Hemings, the woman known as Thomas Jefferson's slave and mistress? For years, this was a hidden history, but with DNA, there is now historical consensus. She was a 14-year-old, just a girl who lived in a small windowless room with a dirt floor off of Thomas Jefferson's bedroom at Monticello. Not only was she his slave, but she was Jefferson's wife's half-sister, conceived by his father-in-law. So yeah, Jefferson's wife brought her infant stepsister, Sally, whom she had inherited, to their marriage. Sally's mother before her was also biracial, having been conceived by her mother's owner. Sally bore 6 children by Thomas Jefferson, probably in that room. So you cannot tell African-American women that The Handmaid's Tale is a future dystopia. You cannot tell African-American women that Sally Hemings was the mistress of Thomas Jefferson. She was not free to be his mistress. This was not consensual. He owned her. This was rape, forced childbearing, and enslavement of her babies, rape, sex slavery, reproductive slavery, and sex trafficking. How very white it was of me to have understood Handmaid's Tale as a future dystopia for years, as if it were freakishly worse than anything that's ever happened before. I'm so embarrassed that I and other white women related to this novel for years through our white womanhood. And certainly white women's experience is valid, but we white women have got to stop acting like it's universal. As much as we know this intellectually and try not to, we keep inadvertently doing it. And that's my personal unconscious racism that was brought to my attention, and it's institutional racism in the feminist movement. And this is derisively what is called white feminism. White feminism is real, and it's against everything we believe in. It's our hypocrisy, and we have got to get our act together. And of course, this stuff goes back further than that. In the story of Abraham, the patriarch of the three Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, we're told that God told the elderly, childless Abraham and Sarah that nations would descend from them. Sarah laughed and asked Abraham to use her Egyptian servant, Hagar, as a surrogate to fulfill this expectation. So Sarah and Abraham are revered as the matriarch and patriarch of three great religions and models of faith. But calling Hagar a surrogate is whitewashing this story. Sarah arranged Hagar's rape and forced childbearing, and then, after Sarah miraculously bore her own son Isaac, she kicked Hagar and her son Ishmael out into the wilderness. Ishmael is traditionally held to be the progenitor of the people of Islam. Again, rape, sex slavery, and reproductive slavery, and sex trafficking. So powerful forces have always and repeatedly sought to colonize reproduction for its own manipulation of demographics and advancement of its power, whether this is perpetrated by slaveholders, the government, the church, or the Republican Party, and the Democratic Party has done it too at times. In the century or more after the end of legal slavery in the United States, eugenics and sterilization were forced on black women, poor women, and people with disabilities. In fact, Indiana was the first state to legalize involuntary sterilization in 1907. At the same time, birth control was outlawed for white women in order to coerce more children than they wanted. So reproductive oppression can take the form of forced reproduction or forced sterilization, whatever serves the institutional agenda. So the narrow lens of abortion politics that we have come to think of commonly as reproductive rights has only been around for 40 years. That stuff is new. Abortion was intentionally politicized into the Christian right by the Republican Party as part of the Southern strategy in the Reagan years. It was a device that substituted for the power of racism after the Civil Rights era, when overt racism stopped being acceptable. So the pro-life, pro-choice dichotomy was contained in this artificial silo, apart from all other aspects of sexuality and reproduction that naturally should be a part of sexual and reproductive freedom. In 1994, after the famous International Conference on Population and Development in Cairo, the plans for promoting global family planning to alleviate world poverty left African-American women very frustrated. 2 months later, the Black Women's Caucus of the Pro-Choice Alliance met in Chicago. It was very clear to them that pushing family planning on poor people and protecting abortion rights did not actually advance the well-being of poor women of color around the world as much as they needed. So the so-called pro-choice position was a mockery of choice to subjects of population control. Limiting people's fertility is not as welcome and benevolent as it sounds to people whose children are hungry. So a dozen black women stayed up late in Loretta Ross's hotel room and developed the framework of reproductive justice. It is a human rights framework, not civil rights. Human rights are rights by birth. and civil rights are rights by citizenship. So reproductive justice is the human right to have a baby, the right to not have a baby, and the right to raise your baby in conditions where new life can thrive. That is it. It is simple, and it is radical, especially the more you work with it. So if we can pull back from 40 years of abortion politics, let's consider reproductive justice through the wide scope of world history and the wide range of ways that sexuality can be distorted and reproduction can be coerced. This, of course, includes oppression of LGBTQ people. The worth and dignity of each person surely means that everyone's sexuality and reproductive capacity belongs to them and is theirs to use to enhance their own well-being and that of their family. Sexual and reproductive capacity is an inherent part of being human and being whole. Human reproduction is not a public resource. It is private. We as a society are responsible to assure it is protected from exploitation by powerful forces and institutions. So this shifts the paradigm of abortion politics from a clash of competing rights between a fetus and a pregnant woman to just being about human flourishing. Reproductive justice means access to maternal health care, affordable safe housing and child care, clean air and water, immigrant rights, voting rights, and Black Lives Matter. Reproductive justice means access to the basic conditions that self-determined families need to thrive and to support people in the decisions they make to take care of themselves and their families. Carolyn's going to talk about some instances of how that is applied very, very recently and very, very close to home.
So one of my favorite things is to facilitate Our Whole Lives classes and trainings. And for many years, Sue Ellen and I facilitated OWL at an urban community center in Indianapolis. And there were many youth of color there. These youth loved to challenge us, the middle-aged white women. They taught us quite a bit about oppression and injustice. One of my favorite readings in OWL is that famous speech that I just read a little while ago by Sojourner Truth, "Ain't I a Woman?" It is such a powerful statement, and it always takes the youth by surprise. Another powerful woman that I admit I am a fan of is Michelle Obama. She said this recently, "The measure of any society is how it treats its women and girls." So, how does Indiana treat its women and girls? Well, right, not so good. Public health rankings reflect that Indiana is 36th out of 50th for overall women and children's health. So this means that we are 14 states from being the worst. We rank 41st in intimate partner violence, 38th for children with two or more adverse childhood experiences, 49th for rape of high school girls, 28th for teen suicide, 11th for HPV vaccination of females, and that's 13 to 17-year-olds, not bad, but 43rd for HPV vaccination of males, same age. We rank 35th for teen births, 36th for infant mortality, and 44th for maternal mortality. So our public health metrics are abysmal, and generally women and children of color have higher metrics than white people, such as infant mortality. Did you know that pregnancy outcomes and health status are far more dependent on social determinants of health than medical care? Health disparities exist between people of color and those who are white. One reason for these disparities is racism, both individual and institutional racism. Racism causes stress. It releases a hormone called cortisol. This is kind of the fight or flight response. And it impacts severely the health of pregnant women and the developing fetus. It causes high blood pressure, low birth weight, and ruptured membranes. Even middle-class educated black women have much worse pregnancy outcomes than white women, even if they receive good prenatal care. Nationally, black women are 4 times more likely to die than white women during pregnancy, and twice as likely for their infants to die in the first year of life. This is also true for Native women and Latinas. Immigrant women from African and Latino countries, when they first arrive in the U.S., they have better health than their U.S. counterparts. The longer they live in the U.S., the worse their health outcomes. Racism is truly bad for people's health. When religion, law, and medicine collude, reproductive health care is at risk. Indiana is known for legislating on the basis of morality and religion. Red states like Indiana pass laws in the name of public health and safety, but realize outcomes that just are the exact opposite of health and safety. A new report which analyzes legislative actions found that states with the most abortion restrictions enacted have the fewest policies proven to support the health of women and children. So I'd like to tell you the story about two women in Indiana. These two women have been incarcerated for outcomes of their pregnancy that didn't result in a healthy baby. Both these women were women of color. Both owned restaurants. Both were hardworking and women of integrity. For political reasons, overzealous prosecutors used principles of personhood to justify their arrests. Personhood is a political strategy to create a standard legal definition of a person, which begins the moment an egg is fertilized by sperm. Personhood disavows the legal rights of the pregnant woman in favor of the fetus. Assigning legal rights to a fetus is paradoxical when it is dependent on the complex systems of a pregnant woman's body that must nurture a full-term baby, or nurture a baby into full term. Personhood is our modern Handmaid's Tale reality. So here are the stories of Bebe Shui and Purvi Patel. They're Indiana's modern handmaids. In 2010, at age 34, a pregnant Chinese immigrant named Bebe Shui, she lived in central Indiana, was depressed after her partner abandoned her and left her and took all her saved funds for the baby's hospital bills, or for the future baby's hospital bills. She grew so despondent that she tried to kill herself with rat poison. She was 33 weeks pregnant. Friends found her and intervened, and she survived and received help for her depression. The premature newborn she delivered by undergoing cesarean section survived for only 3 days. Prosecutors charged her with murder, defined to include viable fetuses. An attempted feticide, defined to include ending a pregnancy at any stage. This happened despite the fact that attempting suicide is not a crime in Indiana, even though the murder and feticide laws in Indiana were specifically passed to address people who harm pregnant women, not treat women who became pregnant as potential criminals. So Bebe served 18 months in jail and eventually was offered a plea bargain after the judge recommended it to the prosecutor. 7 to 20% of pregnant women suffer from mental illness or severe depression that may lead them to attempt to end their lives. Indiana, like every other state in this country, addresses suicide and attempted suicide as a public health issue, not a crime. There's wide consensus that subjecting pregnant women to special criminal penalties does not work. Rather, it undermines women. It undermines the legitimate interest in maternal, fetal, and child health by stigmatizing pregnant women and by making them vulnerable to punishment if they seek help of any kind. Here's the story of Purvi. In 2013, 33-year-old Purvi Patel went to a Catholic hospital in South Bend, Indiana. She was bleeding, she was in pain, she was bleeding heavily after a pregnancy loss. Purvi comes from a family of Hindu immigrants from India, and she runs the family restaurant to support her parents and ailing grandparents. The doctor who saw her suspected that she induced a late abortion and called the police. When Purvey woke up after sedation, there was a police officer stationed by her bed. The obstetrician had left the hospital and joined the police in a search for the fetus. A 1-pound fetus was indeed found by the police in a dumpster. Despite hospital tests showing no traces of any abortifacient in her blood work, the state of Indiana charged her with both feticide for allegedly inducing an abortion and child neglect for allegedly having a premature baby and then allowing the baby to die. Prosecutors argued that Purvey illegally sought to terminate her own pregnancy with abortifacients ordered online. She didn't seek prenatal care, and apparently she attempted to keep her pregnancy a secret from her Indian family. They also used a discredited 100-year-old lung float test to prove that the 23-week fetus was born alive. So on March 30th, 2015, Purvey was convicted of both crimes, and she was sentenced to 20 consecutive years in prison. She did appeal her sentence and ended up only serving 18 months of those 20 consecutive years. During that time, though, the franchise owners dropped her family's franchise in South Bend, so they lost their restaurant, and her grandmother died. The Indiana Court of Appeals reduced the child neglect charge against Purvey and threw out the feticide charge. So in a 42-page ruling, Judge Crone chastised prosecutors for charging Purvey under the state's 2009 feticide law, finding that the legislator did not intend for that feticide statute to apply to illegal abortions or to be used to prosecute women for their own abortions. The court agreed with Purvey's appeal attorneys and the doctors who made the case. The state did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the fetus could have survived had she had done anything differently. The news of Indiana's prosecution of women with pregnancy loss is overwhelming and discouraging. Purvey's appeal finding does give us a little bit of hope, though. Both women have struggled post-incarceration to cope with their new realities. Unfortunately, both are very strong. Baby is still in Indianapolis. She has a business, and she's struggling till today. She worked very hard to get her green card because she lost her immigration status immediately when she accepted the plea. The news is she is returning home to visit family. She has not seen her parents in China for many, many years, and she is finally going to be able to do that, but she still struggles quite a bit. Purvey has moved to the Chicago area after many months, finally obtained a job. She's lived with her family. He's happy, but angry. So as people of values and conscience, there's much for us to do. In 2015, the UUA adopted a statement of conscience for taking action for reproductive justice. Did you know that the UUA is the first denomination to study reproductive justice? It is the UUA's long history of progressive witness for freedom and justice that has allowed this study to take place. By adopting statements of support in civil rights, by adopting LGBTQ people facing oppression, and by offering lifespan sex-positive sexuality education that is steeped in the seven values, that has all laid the groundwork for considering the framework of reproductive justice. As Unitarian Universalists, we are called to answer the stigmatizing political debate on reproductive rights with calls for reproductive justice and respect for the fullness of every person's reproductive and sexual life. Did you know there's a six-week curriculum on the UUA website? It's available, easy to implement. It doesn't look that difficult. It's rooted in religious history and theological callings. It outlines the distinctions between reproductive health, reproductive rights, and reproductive justice. Undertaking this curriculum would be a positive step forward in understanding reproductive oppressions, in learning about yourself as sexual and reproductive beings, and equipping you to move forward as a congregation with integrity and vision.